Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, on Friday, October 23rd, 2009, I'm delighted to be joined by Morley Winograd and Michael D. Haas, co-authors of Millennial Makeover, MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics. Morley and Michael, are you with us?
Morley is very much here. Michael probably responds to Michael Hayes.
Sorry, Michael Hayes. Are you with us? Well, I guess we're waiting on Michael.
Morley, how get started, huh?
That's okay. We're on live now. Morley, how are you?
I'm good.
Great. I'm very good, thank you. So let's get going. So I you know, we'll, as soon as Michael joins, we'll include him in the discussion.
Sure.
But the thing that's fascinating to me about this book is I think one of the things that it illuminated for me was really looking at the dimensions of, you know, trends between generations in a way that, for whatever reason, this book captured it for me in a way that others haven't, and subsequent webinars that you and Michael have done that as well. So my question, I guess, to start with is, since the book's been out a while and now it's available in paperback, folks, so you can get to the book very easily by going to the page where you're viewing right now and clicking on the book. But if when you were initially, you know, maybe before the election when the book came out, what were you initially asked the most, do you think?
Well, there were two questions that were raised by our really all the way back to the manuscript when we solicited a proposal for the book. The first question was, are you crazy? Because nobody believed that American politics would shift so dramatically in 2008, back before the actual events of the election, certainly in 2007 when we were writing the book, and even in early 2008 when the book came out. Most people were still thinking in a linear paradigm about politics, that is, and history in general, which is things follow one, follow the next. And, of course, one of the great insights of Strauss and Howe's generational theory is that history is not linear, that it actually circles back upon itself about every 80 years with dramatic events and mood changes every 20 years as different generations arrive. The other question we got a lot of, what are you two old guys writing about these young millennials? You don't know anything about them. And, of course, Michael's extensive survey research data gave us a response to that question and actually gave us a response to the first question, because the survey research data, which we initiated through Frank N. Magid Associates for the writing of the book, was very clear that this dramatic break between generations was true in its attitudes and beliefs. And then subsequently, the Pew Research Foundation did a series of polls which also validated that data. And so instead of, you know, those sort of attacks on our personal capability and qualifications to make such a forecast, we got into the data and the reality of the situation.
Now, I think Michael has joined us now. Michael, are you with us?
I am indeed. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I'm sorry, I mispronounced your name initially. Morley quickly corrected me.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Oh, well, I apologize. So,
no problem.
Thank you for joining us on the show. As I mentioned, folks can take a look at the book. And I was just asking Morley kind of what the initial, in the initial release of the book, and I mentioned that it's out in paperback now, what was the question that you remember being asked the most? So I'll pose that question to you as well so you can weigh in on, you know, thinking back, you know, what struck you as, you know, kind of a common theme of questioning?
Well, I think there were, first of all, the things I did hear Morley's response to that question, and clearly he is correct in his answer in the kind of questions we got. But in addition, I think that we probably, if any question we heard beyond that was, well, okay, so these kids are one way now, and, you know, they like Obama, and they're Democrats now, and they're liberals now. But in, you know, when they go through the knocks of life and see how hard it is in this world, aren't they going to become conservative? because doesn't everybody start out as a radical or a liberal and then become increasingly conservative as they age? And as Morley indicated, because these generations circle back on themselves, because this is all very cyclical, they in fact will not necessarily become conservative or Republican as they age, but will keep a lot of these, their basic core beliefs about politics pretty much the way they are today throughout the entirety of their lives once they are used to voting in a particular way for an election or two. And one example we gave of how that happens is that the last previous generation of this type, the GI generation that's like the millennials, was and still is, those who are still living, lifelong Democrats, and the only two generations in 2004 that voted for John Kerry were the very last sliver of members of the GI generation and the very earliest millennials who are coming in to vote, and all of the other generations in between voted for George W. Bush.
For your listeners, the GI generation is, of course, born in the beginning of the 20th century between 1901 and 1924. They formed the core of FDR's support in his tenure for the New Deal, and voted regularly Democratic and never stopped voting that way.
Yeah, and I think there's a few people probably that were influenced by that are still around too, because there's that piece too that I wanted to ask you about, which is, you know, how much are for folks that haven't necessarily read the book or don't know a lot about your findings, you know, generally speaking, how much of political opinion is formed in the home, and the thoughts that whether your family is a Democratic family or Republican family, or independent or green, I guess today, whatever slant they or particular position they may support or party. Does that follow through into the rest of their lives, and is there at some point where people sort of break away from that?
Well, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I can try to answer that, and it's interesting. Way back when 30, 40 years ago, when I was studying political science in grad school for my various degrees. The general belief at that point was that people pretty much followed their parents' party identification. So Democrats raised Democrats, Republicans raised Republicans. There were some exceptions, but basically that was the belief. But a lot of that research was conducted in the middle of an era when party labels, party identification was pretty solid. So, you know, in the 1950s and 1960s, we were not in a period of realignment and things hadn't changed yet. And so I'm not sure that the answer holds for all time. And so, you know, I do think there is more likely to be divergence at various points in history when these big changes occur, when we reach a turning point in one of our cycles. So sometimes I think people are more likely to follow party identification of their parents. At others, significant numbers move to a different party.
And we are in one of those periods where the parental influence on party and politics is pretty minimal. Obviously, this particular generation, the millennials, voted 2-1 for Barack Obama, but no other generation came close to that. In fact, the oldest generation, which might be more their grandparents than their parents, voted for John McCain in terms of majority vote, and boomers were evenly split. So it's not possible to predict this generation's political allegiance based upon its parental influence. And as Mike pointed out, that's what happens in realignments. Certainly the GI generation had nothing to do with the Republican orientation of its parents back from the, you know, solid 40 years of Republican rule prior to 1932. What does matter, I would say, however, that what does matter with regard to parents is how they raise their children. That has a very big impact on generational attitudes and beliefs. Mm. Even conservative Republican parents, not all of them, but obviously some of them, have raised this particular generation with an attitude towards group decision-making and consensus and the importance of including people, in a way that causes millennials to have more of a collective spirit than their parents did. And that's because some of the lessons that their parents imparted to them, and some of it's from the influence of their peers and their friends.
I think that's true, and I think another factor which makes a difference, particularly for this type of generation, for the GI generation and the millennial generation, which, as Morley mentioned, Strauss and Howe referred to as a civic generation, very often these civic generations tend to be in large numbers the children of immigrants. So in many senses, their parents were not necessarily a part of the American political process. It is an important point. In the 1920s and 30s, when the GIs were growing up, they were disproportionately the children of Southern and Eastern Europeans who had come to America in the last big wave of immigration. And right now, millennials, 40% of millennials are non-white, by far the largest of any generation, and 1 in 5 of the children have at least one immigrant parent. So maybe the parents have no political allegiances in the United States, but the children certainly develop them.
There's also the final factor here, and it's all very important and adds up to a major sea change, is the relative difference in birth rates within the population. The more affluent, Mike has a colorful quote in the book, or we have a colorful quote in the book about all that, but the more affluent the family, just generally around the world, the less likely they are to have large families. And the less affluent, the more likely more children are needed to help provide financial security for the family in their old age. And so you do get democratically leaning families having, not you can't say this generally, but for the most part, larger families, particularly those from the lower socioeconomic scale, than those at the upper end.
So what is this sort of, when I talk to people about different things, different aspects in the book, or as I mentioned earlier in webinars that you guys have done that have been really interesting, one of them, Morley, you talk about, is it parachute parenting or, the parents
helicopter
come in.
Parenting.
Helicopter parenting. And you actually describe it.
They don't pop in, they hover.
Yeah, but they, well, you know, you one specific example that actually I went to a event right after I caught part of a webinar, and so I used that example. I said, I couldn't believe that, in the example that you gave was in negotiating for a position, a job, your first job out of college, let's say, your parent might come in to negotiate salary for you or with you or on your behalf or whatever that might be. And so I used this anecdote around and, met with a few, it was mostly, the VC community, CFOs, and some lawyers, and met with a human resources lawyer for a very large technology company here who actually said that they were having to change rules, and that was actually a topic that came up in different law, HR related, courses that she'd take or gatherings about what to do, because there's this obviously a lot of legal issues after someone is 18 years old.
Right.
But I was curious, you guys showed the two Time magazine
right.
cover stories, for example, there's a lot of information about millennials, and I'm sure we'll go back into that. But the question always seems to come back to me, and of course it relates to me because I'm Generation X. What does this mean for Generation X?
Well,
how
I've
involved
had, we've had
are
some,
they?
Yeah, we've had some very interesting conversations recently on that topic. First of all, the two cover stories you allude to for your listeners. Our 1990 and a 2000 cover story. The 1990 cover story portrays in pictorial format a Gen X set of folks who are all dressed in black, not looking at each other, clearly conveying alienation and distance, whereas the Newsweek actually article cover story 10 years later picturing millennials as them all dressed in colorful clothing, hugging each other, underwear hanging out, and all the rest of it. and it's usually excites, it usually generates a great deal of commentary from Gen Xers in the audience, because first of all, there's still a lingering resentment among Gen Xers about that cover story in Time. It was written by a boomer. The subtext of the, even on the cover, is that Gen X will never be as good as boomers. There aren't as many of them. They're slackers. They're not good people. all of those generational stereotypes were portrayed, even as, or implicit in the article, even as it was supposedly writing an objective article about the generation. So finally, having gotten sort of out from under the shadow of the boomers, because Gen Xers have taken major leadership positions, in particular in Silicon Valley, using their entrepreneurial and pragmatic skills, along comes another large generation. There's, I think, Mike, twice as many millennials as there are Gen Xers, or close to it. Along comes another generation that seems to be, in the minds of many Gen Xers, demanding that the world adjust to them, and that everything needs to be done to cater to them in order to hire them, recruit them, keep their parents happy in their job, as you indicated in your opening comments about helicopter parents. And Gen Xers saying, wait a minute, we finally got in a position of authority here, and now we've got these young people coming to work who think they're entitled to everything, and it's just not fair. I mean, our generation should be given a chance to lead. Well, first of all, we don't think that the world should simply be adjusted to millennial attitudes and beliefs, particularly in the workplace. On the other hand, it is true that in the next decade or so, Mike has the exact dates, the millennials will make up one out of every three adult Americans, and so it's going to be hard to ignore them, even if boomers by then have all retired. So our suggestion for Gen Xers is use your considerable entrepreneurial skills to learn how to team with this generation, take advantage of its net savviness. Even though Gen Xers are very technologically savvy, they didn't grow up with the Internet as millennials did, and so there's a difference in comfort level and skill in many cases with that. Take advantage and appreciate millennials' desire and ability to work as a group, which drives Gen Xers crazy, who would rather get things done on their own. But use that, leverage that in organizational settings so that it becomes something that you can build upon as opposed to push off or resent.
And just to go back into history, because, again, this is very cyclical, the last type of generation that was like the Gen X generation was the so-called lost generation of the 1920s. By the time the United States went into World War II, most of our great generals, like Patton and Eisenhower, were members of that generation, and their ability to mold, to use the group orientation of the members of the GI generation, essentially won World War II for this country. So, it is a skill. The generation of that type, the Gen X, brings certain skills with it that are very useful in for the country and for corporations within the country in guiding those corporations to good things and utilizing millennials, that type of generation.
And do you think that government, in terms of, I mean, what's interesting to me, as a Gen Xer is my mom tells the story always of working, working and being, wanting to have children at in the 1970s, the height of the feminist movement, and, not being afraid, actually, of telling her boss that she was going to have a baby, so they actually had to come to her and ask her, are you expecting? Because, something's going on with you. It's interesting, I think, that, that was one of the carryovers for me that I took away was, the ability to kind of be, a little bit more direct and open with emotions, feelings, what we're doing or planning with, but also, some of the feminists and other tides that came through from the late 1960s and 1970s of that sort of, kind of free love, that whole, kind of, for lack of a better term, hippie movement, I guess, that kind of, settled into the first part of, or some of us Generation Xers that were influenced by that. And I wonder, with millennials, what are the kind of movements that are, that they can hearken back to that their parents may have shared with them about the around the time that they were born?
Michael, you want to go or you want me to go?
Well, I can start with that, and then Morley can finish up. In terms of movements, I think what millennials will take from this is, in a sense, they are the beneficiaries of a lot of the things that were going on there. Not the whole idea of of female equality, of racial equality, that sort of thing. Millennials are, you know, kind of avoid those issues now because for them the issues have been resolved. So millennials, for example, right now are the most female dominant or driven generation in American history. A majority of college students and those in professional schools are female. We are about to reach a point fairly soon where a majority of the workforce is actually going to be female, and millennials also don't really view the world through racial lenses or ethnic lenses. We're all the same. Millennials feel, for example, that virtually all that interracial dating is fine, that they have something in common with people of other races. And so I think in a way those movements have made a difference, but it's just in day-to-day life. It isn't that millennials are even concerned with those issues because those issues have kind of gone beyond them. I think the millennials simply are more concerned with basic economic and foreign policy concerns rather than the social issues, because, again, I think those have been resolved to the satisfaction of most of them.
So what you'll see is movements from millennials towards group action and greater social and economic equity in all civic eras, and the one led by GIs, this one, ones previous in the 19th century and even the 18th century. The demand from society has been for more equitable treatment and more equitable outcomes, actually, in society. And so you see, yesterday's announcements on pay and compensation being determined by the government for the financial sector, which would have been unheard of in an era dominated by Gen Xers and Gen X attitudes. The movement towards national health care, whatever shape it might take in its final outcome, is all about equity and the fact that everybody ought to be able to get health insurance, and the pushbacks are all about cost and government role, but that's a traditional debate that millennials come down on the side of civic and government involvement. The tendencies in American history when these kinds of generations take over is to reinvigorate and or build new institutions as opposed to social movements, to get at Mike's point. So the rebellion, which every generation has in one form or another, is not against the institutions. It's against the culture of lack of accountability, a Gen X attitude, and lack of responsibility, a millennial attitude. And it wasn't purely coincidental that the focus and the theme of President Obama's inaugural address was about the new era of responsibility. That's something that millennials can relate to very much. So they wouldn't pick up free love or anti-cultural kinds of vibes from their boomer or Gen X predecessors. They would instead pick up the importance, they would understand from that history, the importance of movements by people coming together, and then they would reinforce that coming together in ways designed to reform institutions.
So following up on that just a little bit deeper, you know, does this mean that in Generation X, finally, we've come to the colorblind era? And what does that mean for, you know, some of the political programs of the 1990s that were about, you know, creating opportunity and equity among racial and financial lines?
Well, you come to the so-called post-racial society more as the millennial generation becomes more and more a part of the adult population, as well as the generation that follows them, which is just entering kindergarten right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it will build off Gen X's movement towards celebrating diversity, enforcing non-discriminatory policies, which really started all the way back with the Silent Generation's civil rights movement. But all of that builds towards a society in which distinctions and boundaries based upon a person's ethnicity or gender will be looked upon skeptically or simply not understood as why would we care about that particular distinction. And we're not there yet, nor is our daily practice there yet. I don't mean to imply that it is. But within that generation is the beginnings of that post-racial society.
Interesting. So, Michael, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think Morley is correct about that. It is going to be the millennials who are much more concerned about it and much more likely to lead the country into the post-racial era. For at least for them, I think they are to some degree post-racial, but older generations have not yet reached that point, and the older the generation, kind of the more distant from that goal they are. I think also the whole question, for example, of issues such as free love, millennials are very much into responsibility, and so I would expect that they would be much less likely. I mean, there are the stats on things like teen pregnancy and things like that are actually down for this generation, because I think they would view such things, and even things such as abortion perhaps, as not responsible. That it isn't something that you would necessarily support. It just isn't the right way to go.
And that's a very important generational. That's a very important generational distinction, Jennifer, because millennials' voting behavior is so liberally oriented, particularly when it comes to economics and to some degree in foreign policy. People assume that they are like liberals that we used to know. And they're not. They're very conventional when it comes to social rules. They believe they were taught by their parents that rules are important. Their parents were taught by Bill Cosby on the Huxtable Show about how important rules are and how to discipline kids without hitting them. And so they understand that rules are important. They just want to understand the rules so they can save the world within the rules, kind of the way Harry Potter does.
Right. In a way, it's they are more like the liberals of the 1940s, 50s, and early 1960s, where the liberalism is a matter of things such as dealing with economic issues, economic equality, that kind of thing, and less inclined toward what became liberalism, which was kind of social issue liberalism.
So, in
the later 60s and 70s.
So for instance, in 1929, the wealthiest 1% of Americans owned 50% of the nation's wealth, and that number had shrunk dramatically by 1949 under the influence of that earlier generation's public policies. I think it ended up down in the 30% range. I'd have to see the precise charts, but it was dramatically lower. And, of course, it rose over the years from 1949 to 2008 as the influence of the New Deal GIs waned, but it has shrunk dramatically and will continue to shrink dramatically since 2008, beginning with the financial crisis and the reduction and the destruction of Wall Street wealth, but now going on into tax policies and other issues that will come along, you will see that again, that narrowing of the gap between the richest and the poorest, because that's a gap that millennials don't believe should exist.
So going, a little bit into, the social media side of things, I observed some interesting behavior and was curious what your take was, if you saw anything particular on social networks that you may use or just even in discussion that you may be having around the awarding of a Nobel Prize to our president. Because there were definitely as someone who works in social media, there were definitely distinctive, I thought, generational differences in the response, and happened to be up very late, and so caught it very early in the morning when it first broke and saw kind of the initial tide. And so one of the things I would point to is an example of someone noticing that tide that's sort of high profile and known for being very liberal is Michael Moore, who initially had a particular knee-jerk reaction and then sent out another email either later in the day or the next day saying, wait a minute, maybe I thought about this the wrong way and I think I changed my mind. What did you observe before I get into what anybody specifically thought?
Well, did you mean email? I mean, such an old-fashioned method.
When I'm talking about social interaction, I guess any electronic social interaction. So it can include email.
Because millennials basically don't use email.
They usually use Facebook mail or chat
or IM and text, right?
Right. So I
saw.
Because
it's more instantaneous, and even the email capability in Facebook is deliberately limited because it's not really for daily use as a communication vehicle.
Online yeah, and
chat would be better. And so and you know, we can talk about Facebook, but also we can't leave out the MySpace piece of it, which has a different demographic and therefore a different reaction. And if we wanted to go through the list, you'd also want to look at the twittering and that went on about that particular award.
That the twittering was what, and the tweets that feed into Facebook
yes.
were what I could, you know, saw. I saw that as one particular. You know, there was definitely a huge opinion, and you know, if you were inclined to feel peer pressure, I guess, you know, you wouldn't go against that tide.
Correct.
And then the Facebook folks that were just using Facebook, which if you work in this area or you study it, you can see the difference between the two. You know, was clearly different. So I was just curious what your take was before I give you kind of my impression, because when I got on Twitter, I was aghast, I guess, is the best,
well,
the best word.
I mean, peer pressure, a title we once considered for our book, cannot be ignored in the decision-making process of millennials on the Nobel Peace Prize and whether it was deserved or not. It's just an example of that. I mean, most millennials operate in consensus-driven decision-making mode.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the degree that a social media like Twitter, which is so much faster and responsive than something as creaky as email, can generate a wave of opinion that appears to be everybody's opinion, then millennials will agree with it because they're not interested in going against the group. If you came into MySpace, you would never find, you would be unlikely to find much in the way of disagreement about his whether he deserved the prize or not, because the ethnicity and demographics of MySpace is very supportive of President Obama. Facebook, interestingly enough, represents a little more of a middle ground because,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of my friends who post there on my profile and my wall are very right-wing, and so I use it to sort of get different aspects of opinions and see how people react. But that still represents a unique subset of all Americans, and the degree to which you can conduct a more reasoned debate on Facebook is to their credit. But millennials are still likely to go not with what experts think, but with what their friends think.
I guess I can talk a little bit about, too, I have seen survey research on this that does suggest that for a variety of reasons, millennials are more supportive of the president receiving that award, partly because of ethnicity, partly because they obviously like Obama, but also because they really do see that even though it's difficult to point to specific achievements that warrant that award, that nevertheless he does seem to be resting American foreign policy in a very different direction, and so the sense of aspiration, I think they would believe, is something that should be rewarded in addition to simply, well, yes, he has achieved A, B, C, and D.
I would assume, though, Jennifer, we'll let you speak. I would assume that as a Gen Xer, the lack of substantive accomplishment, bottom line results, which is an area that Gen Xers are always focused on, by the president so far in his administration, you can point to a couple, but obviously it's kind of early. The lack of that bottom line accomplishment might bother Gen Xers a lot more than it would millennials.
So that is exactly what I found on Twitter, was huge dissent from folks that had been tweeting in favor of Obama. So on, you know, specific to Twitter, I found, you know, a huge negative reaction, and I mean fiercely negative. And then the retweeting, which, you know, hopefully has a comment that gives some context to a person's opinion, not just a here's my thumbs up like button on Facebook, but actually does indicate some more critical thinking. And so when I started traversing that, you know, I was finding, you know, people still really dissenting heavily. And my own personal take was a positive one because, you know, what I was, you know, in my mind, my husband happens to be English and his family lives in different parts of the world. And so I'm very attuned personally to how the world views U.S. politics and how it impacts them. You know, for example, in the U.K. right now, their mail centers are switching from Newcastle to London to, you know, wherever, the major cities, which is causing just panic among folks trying to get mail, which is, you know, I mean, you would think is the most easy way to really communicate for a lot of, especially the older generation. So, you know, my husband's parents are a little bit older than my parents. So for them, it's like, you know, this is a basic right to be able to communicate. And yet even mail is now in flux. And, you know, the U.S. is looked at as partially or largely, depending on the person, to blame for that because of, you know, the mortgage crisis and then the larger economic fallout.
Yeah, it's hard to avoid that blame, but go ahead.
Yeah, so what I found is, you know, for me, I just felt very personally proud of our country, that we, you know, that it obviously, you know, the committee, you know, had found something uniquely special or unique about the kind of leader that we elected, and it was a nice reflection on our judgment, our attitudes, and hopefully mending some fences on an international scale. And that was maybe more what I personally was thinking. And so I was quite offended, actually, at some of the things that I was reading and then the subsequent blog posts that started being passed around. On Facebook, I found, you know, and I always say it's the beautiful melding of the three generations when I do different speaking events, because I think, you know, you do get a larger, especially if you have a large network, you get lots of different opinions from lots of different parts of the country, too. And, you know, I found a far less vehement dissent. I mean, there was certainly that, you know, partially because of the connection between Twitter and Facebook statuses. But I found that, you know, just from my personal network, a lot less, you know, what I would consider anger about the award. And I really, you know, I found that odd. And I just didn't know if, you know, either of you had seen any sort of data that had pointed to any particular frustration to the point of anger about the award.
Well, as Mike said, not for millennials.
Yeah,
no,
not for
millennials.
I wouldn't say Twitter. I mean, millennials really, I mean, I consider Twitter really, and maybe I'm wrong in saying this, but it seems like, and maybe it's just the crowd that I follow, is very Gen X focused.
Yes.
Right.
So, actually, Jennifer, too, you mentioned the impact of international opinion, and I have seen data on that. And, of course, millennials are very able to deal. They're very internationalist, and many of them have, of course, an international background. Majority of them have traveled to other countries. And so they are very good on the international stage, better than other generations. But Pew has does an ongoing survey every year or so in which they interview large samples of people in 25 different countries, and with one exception, and these countries are in all regions of the world, with one exception, since President Obama was inaugurated, attitudes toward the United States have improved markedly. I think the sense in most of the world was that this country that most people in the world would like to believe in lost its way in the recent past, and at least President Obama, they believe, has the potential to restore America to its rightful place of democratic, small D democratic leadership.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, the one country where those results are not true is Israel, which is concerned about the United States drifting away from its alliance with that country.
Interesting. You know, one thing that you know, that international piece, I think, you know, makes me think about is, you know, how much of, you know, American politics you know, is influenced by where we live regionally in the country. I've said during the last two major presidential elections that, and not, I don't mean Kerry, so I mean when Al Gore ran, and you know, now when Barack Obama ran and had the experience, which I've blocked about, of having posters, or we you know, eventually got the lawn sign, which if you want purchase any of that kind of stuff to put out, if you didn't go to a campaign office, could take quite a long time to actually reach you. So we were very excited when we got our lawn sign, which we're very much not lawn sign people, but we did put a lawn sign out, and it was stolen.
Yeah.
And we were surprised, living in a new part of the Bay Area, that kind of told us a little bit about the politics of the area, I guess. But, you know, I thought that was really interesting. And what I said during those two elections to myself or to others, or we discussed at dinner parties, was, you know, the sense of feeling disconnected from the rest of the country. And I use the example of, in my career, I took a break, went to journalism school, and one of the courses I took was on politics throughout the country, and we explored the American South. So I went to states I'd probably never go to, on my own, I'll admit. But, you know, going to Birmingham and going to the American South and through the so-called Bible Belt, and, you know, seeing opinion, conjecture, and the way people conduct themselves being so different than what I was used to, having lived on both coasts in major cities, you know, I wonder how connected can or should Americans really feel to one another when geography seems to – am I wrong in assuming that geography kind of divides us a little bit?
It still does, and you know what? You keep thinking that somehow, as our media becomes more and more national, that those divisions, geographic divisions, regional divisions, are going to lessen, but they don't seem to. And your point about the South being kind of the unusual region of the country, regardless of the era. Certainly in the late 19th century, the South was intensely Democratic. The rest of the country was very Republican, and now that's kind of turned around. So far and away, the South is the most Republican region of the country, the most opposed to Obama. And on the other hand, the Northeast is intensely Democratic. New England, for example, right now, there are no Republicans left in the House of Representatives representing any of the New England states, only three left in New York, and that's in the next couple of weeks is likely to drop down to two. And so the New England, which was once the most Republican area, has become the most Democratic. So those regional differences still seem very slow to disappear.
Well, the differences don't disappear, but the nature of the difference tends to move with realignments. One hopeful sign that this geographical division might not last forever, during the Democratic presidential candidates, white millennials in the South voted more for Barack Obama than they did for Hillary Clinton. So there was a clear signal in that set of data anyway that young white Southerners are not necessarily of the opinion of some of their older leaders when it comes to racial and ethnic tolerance. And we'll have to see over time. I think Mike is right in pointing out the South has always sort of relished its uniquely different attitudes, sort of what everybody else thinks we won't think. But those differences do get ameliorated by generational change and other factors. And, of course, Jennifer, you talked about the two coasts, and Mike talked about the South and the New England. But the real battleground is always in the Midwest. That's why they're called battleground states and bellwether states, where those two perspectives tend to blend. There's, you know, historically Southern migration north, and a lot of Midwest immigrant populations and so forth that cause it, that particular part of the region to be, of the country rather, to be more of a representative sample of overall opinion, and obviously President Obama did very well in the Midwest states, and millennials there, starting in Iowa, had a huge impact on the outcome.
So So part of I think where I feel a disconnect, and I think, you know, when we talk about the South and we talk about some of the opinion, people tend to think about religion, and even seeing Hillary Clinton sort of being much more outwardly religious, I think, you know, that piece couldn't be denied in the last election cycle and probably in the few before it since the election that led to the contract with America, of American politicians being much more, whether they are personally or not is another question, but whether, you know, being much more outwardly religious, thank God for this, thank God for that, that sort of didactic, which, you know, in terms of, you know, if you look at the, you know, other countries, you know, especially, you know, the UK, you know, others that speak are, you know, the same language, finding that a little bit odd. I remember my mother-in-law found that a little bit odd in watching Hillary Clinton speak when she was still in the running. And we were looking at, you know, we showed her a speech of Hillary Clinton, we showed her a speech of Barack Obama, and just to get their take. And, you know, the sense was, you know, religion, you know, why is it sort of inserted so high when it's really political? But we've always had this history, it seems like, of kind of blending the two, though it seems to have reached a fever pitch where you have to, you know, and you know, this was commented on a lot, which is why I'm wondering if there's data around this. You know, how much will we continue to see people feeling the need to be outwardly religious one way or another?
I think the answer is kind of mixed on that. Your relatives are correct. Americans seem to be much more religious. They are almost any survey will indicate that virtually every American claims they believe in God, upwards of 90%, and that's well above the case in any of the Western European countries. And Americans are much more likely to attend services, religious services, on a fairly regular basis. I think it's at least half attend a church or synagogue service weekly, and some even a smaller percentage, even more often than once a week. So I think we are more conventionally religious than people in almost any other country. On the other hand, millennials are less likely to be religious than other generations, and they are certainly less likely to adopt religious symbolism, like feeling like you have to say God bless the United States after the end of every speech. I think to many millennials that sounds like, you know, it's a throwaway line. You got to say it, but you know, whether we necessarily want to believe it or not is another question. I think as we move toward a more civic era, as we are moving into, people will be less concerned with conventional religion. It will not disappear in the United States because it's of the basic culture we have, but those religious concerns, basic religious concerns, I believe will lessen over the next 20 or 30 years.
So religious revivals have a cyclical history of their own in America, and it follows the generational cycle pattern. The first Great Awakening occurred before the Civil War, before the civic generation of that era, with tent revivals and all of those kinds of things. Bringing a spirit a religious spirit to America that was not seen at the time of the founding of the country, when that particular civic generation, the Republican generation, you know, deliberately separated state and religion, and was in many ways, you know, less religious, less had less belief in anything other than potentially a unitary God of some kind than prior or subsequent generations. And then the revivalism that people tend to remember occurred in the 1920s, before the last civic realignment, and we had the Clarence Darrow defense and Williams Jennings Bryan defending the teaching of creationism in the schools, in the famous play, captured in the famous play Gone with the Wind, but a real trial in which the forces of modernity, Darrow, attack the forces of religious belief in William Jennings Bryan, who of course was the Democratic presidential candidate for three different occasions and remained a force in the party even into the Wilson days. And so we've had, and then of course all that disappeared in the 1930s, and people had more fundamental economic concerns, and the religious revivalism went underground again until it burst out before this last realignment in great force in the 90s, and and to some degree in the 80s. And so I would say that we've already seen the fever pitch, and that it will begin to decline, but it won't go away, as Mike pointed out, and it will revive itself, say, about 60 years from now.
Right, and in the meantime, I think what is likely to happen, just as it did in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, is not that people will stop attending services, not that they are all going to suddenly become atheists, but religion will just become much more compartmentalized. It'll be something that people will do on Saturday and Sunday, and Friday, and separate it off from the rest of the rest of the week. It won't be something that's going to be permeating everything that they do from 24 hours a day.
Don't forget the polyglot nature of American society, which millennial generation accelerates, also means a much greater variety in types of religion, because you'll have a significant Muslim population, you'll have significant numbers of Asian beliefs, Buddhists, Hindus, and so forth. And so the ability to make the country a Judeo-Christian bastion will lessen by the very nature of the population, even as those who are sort of really terrified of all of this change continue to emphasize the need for that to be true.
In fact, Morley is right. In fact, at the time of the last previous revival in the 1920s, I doubt that there was a very strong portion of the Judeo-Christian ethic. The sense was it was, Christian rather than Judeo-Christian.
Well,
yeah,
it was Protestant, not even Christian, right?
Right, exactly.
The anti-Catholicism of the 1928 campaign was pretty dramatic.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that there's sort of that sense now that, with Glenn Beck and other folks that are out there commenting and the manner in which they speak, it's, you have to, try to take a step back and think about who they're talking to, with some of the things that are said that, folks worry is hate speech, and how we get from there to being able to say, thank Allah or thank another God for a particular blessing or achievement.
Well, I mean, you always have to keep proportionality in mind. Carville and Greenberg had a great focus group report, sort of capturing the Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh fandom and how terrified they are of the changes occurring in America. That's not a new phenomenon. We've had that in other eras where civic realignment came forward and threatened the old ways of doing business. And Franklin Roosevelt was vilified by the right, for that matter. He was attacked from the left as well. But you have those kinds of "we cannot change, this is fundamentally who this country is, change is bad" kind of attitude that comes in cycles. But the point is that the numbers are not there for that particular point of view to hold sway, because millennials don't, for the most part, hold those attitudes. And again, by 2020, Mike, by 2020, millennials will be one out of every three of adult Americans.
Yeah, I always, when especially in the last election cycle, or the last two, I guess, when there's the hearkening back to Reagan and the Reagan era, I always remember there was, I think, maybe a Barbara Walters special or something that I saw as a kid on the question of why Reagan didn't go to church every Sunday, even though he proclaimed
and
to have
a divorcee, right? The first president.
Well, even beyond that, I don't think they touched on that, or maybe I was too young to really capture what that would mean, or why that would be significant. But I remember him saying that he didn't go to church every week because it would endanger the people, at least in this interview that I saw, that I remember clearly that he said that it would be too dangerous to the other parishioners for him to attend a service.
And today we have the president walking to and from church across the White House, right?
Exactly. So I think, you know, and you know, with a different party and a lot of folks trying to, you know, in the election cycle, trying to juxtapose the two figures when really, you know, it's interesting how they're different but similar and that sort of thing. But getting back to the book in our last few minutes, because I think
the book is Millennial Makeover and available on your website. Yes,
yes, it's available on the site and it's in paperback now. And you know, you guys have this great postscript in the new version of the book, which I think we've kind of focused on a lot here, is sort of the after effect of the election. But what I wanted to ask you about before we part is, you know, what kind of inspired you in the first place to come together and write this book?
Well, Mike and I are devotees of the Strauss and Howe generational theories and have been since the 1980s when their first book, Generations, was published. But we are also shared Dodger season tickets, and so we have a lot of time to talk. And in the course of one of those conversations, we theorized that if Strauss and Howe were correct, and we believe their theory to be correct, we should be seeing a change in American generational voting behavior coming up. And Mike was able to get his former employer, Frank N. Maggot Associates, to do the first polling of millennials since they were studying them for their media behavior for media companies and didn't need them to be 18 years old. But we could do that with millennials 14 to 24 at the time, I think. And we're able to take a look and see if the theory had any data to support it. When the results came back, they were so startlingly accurate with regard to generational theory, but completely disconnected from political commentary, that I think at that point we knew we had a book. As I said at the beginning, we had a little bit of time convincing anybody we were right, but we knew we had a book.
Michael?
No, I think Morley is correct. You know, the one thing is that we actually were Strauss and Howe's work was brilliant and seminal, and it was a great hypothesis of the way the world, the United States, the Anglo-American world runs, but we really did provide the first empirical test of their theories, and I think demonstrated that their theories, their brilliant view of the world, were in fact correct. And the genesis of it is, as Morley said, we were interested in the book. We talked about it, trying to apply its beliefs and theories to the political world at baseball games, and that's really how it started.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point that we'll have to close on is, you know, how much, you know, baseball or any sport can be an American pastime when so many people aren't there to participate
high. Watch millennials' impact on American sports. You're going to see much greater loyalty to teams and much more willingness to sacrifice individual performance for the benefit of the team.
Well, I have to say go Giants because I'm a big Giants fan and, you know, the Dodgers rivalry, you know, you can't not – bring that out, but I think that hopefully on the West Coast we do have some of that, but I think those of us that have lived in the East have seen the fever pitch at which we celebrate the seasons change with the incoming seasons of any particular sport. But
correct.
Michael and Morley, I couldn't thank you more for joining us today to talk about the book. Again, the book is Millennial Makeover, How MySpace, YouTube, and the Future of American Politics, in paperback now with a wonderful postscript that talks about the latest election cycle. Thanks so much, guys, for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And we'll let you get on with your day.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And with that, we want to thank those of you that tuned in to the A-List today with me, Jennifer Lindsay. We hope you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add it to your favorite here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in on Tuesday when my guest will be Christopher Coppola, who's the founder, chair of Project Accessible Hollywood, otherwise known as PAW. Visit pawnation.com for details on the latest. That's 1 week from today at 12 noon Pacific. That's Tuesday at 12 noon Pacific. And on Friday at 12 noon Pacific, I'll be joined by Beth Cantor. Remember to start tweeting or Facebooking in your questions now. And as always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free informational webcasts at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.